Who was the most dominant team in pro football history? The 1972 Miami Dolphins? How about the 1948 Cleveland Browns? They were both undefeated champions of their respective leagues. Or maybe Lombardi's Packers. Or even the 85 Bears. Not so fast. There was a team in mainstream professional football that excelled beyond any of those mentioned above. My name's Darren Hayes, and I'm the author of a book, The World's Greatest Pro Gridiron Team, the 1903 Franklin All-Stars. And I'm proud to say that the Sports History Network is giving away a signed copy of this book to a lucky winner in our latest giveaway, where you can sign up at sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways and get your name entered today. Good luck.
Another episode of the Professional Football Researchers Association podcast underway, and really pleased about today's guest that we are going to have on the show, a man who spent a lot of time in and around the NFL and held a number of different positions in his career during his time as a GM working in the front offices of a couple of different organizations. And that's Ernie Accorsi, who joins George and I now on the PFRA podcast. Ernie, thanks for joining us, and thanks for carving out the time to be on the pod.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I wanted to get this off with a little bit of a fun question this morning. Many people watched the Masters yesterday, and I don't know, didn't really enjoy it that much, at least from my perspective. I've seen better Masters, but I heard in your day, Ernie, you could really launch the golf ball around the course, and that there was a point where you and Arnold Palmer, Wake Forest, were competing to see which one was better. Is that true?
Well, if that competition occurred, neither of us were aware of it, but it wouldn't have lasted very long. I grew up in Pennsylvania, Hershey, Pennsylvania. Arnie grew up in La Trobe, which was pretty, it's about almost 300 miles away in western PA. But I always had a mystique about Wake Forest because of Arnold. And that's one of the reasons I chose to go there, although I was a pretty good high school golfer in this area. But I never really thought I could make that team, and I didn't. I tried out, but I wasn't good enough to play at Wake Forest. But that's one of the reasons I wanted to go there, that and the fact that I loved the ACC basketball, and I wanted to watch that. And you notice none of these reasons are academic. Whatever happened with academics, that was just an added benefit. But I've always a big Arnold Palmer fan. But my first big assignment as a newspaper man in 1965 was to cover the 65 Masters. I was 23 years old, one of the greatest thrills of my life. And you could watch it then. Even a reporter was never allowed inside the ropes, still isn't, whereas the other tournaments they are. And but you could follow everybody then. They kept the crowds down, and that was just a fantastic thrill, even though Nicklaus won it, and won it by a mile over Arnie and Gary Player that year.
Yeah, you got to cover a good one right at the height of the big three being involved in a great sport. I want to ask you from there, because I know that your career, you worked as a journalist, you worked as GM, you had so many hats that you wore over the course of time. How did you go from a kid from Hershey, Pennsylvania, to eventually becoming involved in front offices and football? Take us through your life and how you ended up getting involved in the game of football, Ernie.
Well, I played everything, when I was a kid in Hershey. But I knew, everyone says they dreamt about being the center fielder of the New York Yankees. Well, I was more realistic than that. But I always wanted to be a general manager, and it was in baseball. In the 50s, there weren't really general manager's jobs in the NFL. It was usually the head coach, Paul Brown, or whomever was running these teams, was in charge of personnel. And general manager was a baseball job, and it was, especially if you read the sporting news every week, which is what I grew up on. And I always dreamt about being a general manager. And I had read a book in high school. I got out of a high school library on Branch Rickey, which was written in the 40s. And I was fascinated by the whole aspect of trading building teams. And that's what I wanted and really wanted to do. And of course you'd ask the question then why sports writing? But if you looked at the major administrative jobs in baseball and in sports in general, for the most part, most of them have been former sports writers. All three commissioners have been when I was in college, Walter Kennedy, Pete Rozelle, and Ford Frick. There were people like Gabe Paul, Harry Dalton, that were former sports writers. And the reason was that the organizations were small. The relationship between the media, particularly the writers, and the front offices was cordial. They traveled together. They drank together after games in the hotel bar. And a lot of them were hired when jobs opened, and usually for public relations jobs or whatever. So that was kind of the path. And I thought that, you know, there was no internships. There were no sports administration majors. There was no other way you could really begin to start to get associated with a front office, but to be a sports writer. So I started off, I was a sports editor of the Wake Forest student newspaper, started off as a sports writer, first job in Charlotte, North Carolina. But on my way, even through the different sports writing jobs, the Baltimore Sun and the Philadelphia Inquirer, I had two administration jobs. They were both in college. I was the SID at St. Joseph's in Philadelphia, and then eventually became the assistant at SID at Penn State. And so I always had my eye on the prize, which was to work in administration. And when I went to Penn State, that really got me on the path to the football jobs. I mean, by that time there were general managers. By that time there were front office positions in the NFL, and my whole association was with football once I went to Penn State. But that's the path I took. And as young people have asked me for advice, you know, my first reaction usually is, well, don't look at my career because I don't think you can do it that way anymore. Everything's different in the media now, the whole relationship between the media and organizations. So, you know, there are so many internships available and so many academic paths available that's probably the better way. But that was mine.
Ernie, this is George. I know that when you were at Penn State, I saw an interview that said you worked almost daily with Joe Paterno and that you learned something from him almost on a daily basis. Can you tell us about your relationship with Paterno?
Yeah, everything was smaller in those days, but for some reason, you know, Joe, there weren't people, you know, there weren't interns. I was really a glorified graduate assistant in the administration. And, but for some reason, my boss was Paterno's best friend, Jim Tarman. So because of that, I spent a lot of time around him, and he kind of, for some reason, a special interest in me. And he was tough. I mean, you know, he was, if you didn't do things the way he wanted them done, I mean, he'd let you know it, which was all turned out to be very valuable to me. But mostly, you know, he didn't look at me and say, I'm going to take this kid under my wing. I just paid attention. I remember almost every day when he said things that I thought were really full of wisdom regarding football and sometimes full of life. I mean, I didn't take notes, but when I got home, I wrote everything down. And that was the start of when I started keeping notebooks and tried to make, you know, volumes of notebooks around all the people that I respected in sports and how they did things. And he just would say things on a daily basis. I mean, let's give you an example. One, when do the little things right, the big things will take care of themselves. I mean, little things like that you always thought about, you know, in your career when you had jobs and you thought about little details that maybe you would overlook at times with your eye on a bigger prize. But he was just a wonderful man to be around. Like I said, he was tough. He was very inspirational. He had an emotion about him. And, you know, it was in the beginning of his legacy. I mean, my first year, you know, they had a pretty good year in 67, but he got off to a little bit of a rocky start. And then my first year, we went 11-0 and won the Orange Bowl. And the second year, we went 11-0 and won the Orange Bowl. So, you know, I'd been there for two unbeaten seasons, really. That kind of just launched my career with the Colts. But I had a great background with him. And I never stopped learning from him. I went back very often, very frequently. and stayed close to him all those years and right until the time of his death.
I know you worked briefly in Pete Rozelle's office also. Was that after Penn State and before the Colts?
No, I went from Penn State to the Baltimore Colts, and I always said that, as I just outlined, that Penn State was really on, you know, on a roll at that. Excuse me, I apologize. At that time, and I always said that, you know, the Colts hired a piece of Penn State. They didn't hire me, and they didn't know me from Adam. But Penn State had a little bit of a glitter to it, and that's why, really, why Don Klosterman, who was the general manager of the Colts, I think, hired me. So I spent 5 years as the PR director of the Colts. And Pete Rozelle, having been a PR director of the Rams before he became general manager and then commissioner, always looked out at the PR people in the league. He always thought that that was a great, because of their background in communications and the organizations, most of them were relatively small in the NFL. There weren't that many people in the front office. He would pick out certain PR directors and bring them to New York. He had two jobs there. They were called assistant to the president of the NFC and the AFC. And the president is I got hired as the assistant to the president of the NFC. The president was George Halas, but that was a ceremonial title. I really worked for Rozelle. So I was on his staff between two different stints with the Colts. And I was there for 2 years. And it was pretty much, I mean, you could stay in it if you wanted. Val Pinchbeck was the AFC director, and he stayed there for years. But the NFC job seemed to rotate in terms of about 2 or 3 years. So he really brought you there to take you to the next step of administration and kind of train you for being a possible GM in the future. So then I went back to the Colts as assistant general manager. And then subsequently, I became general manager for a year and a half. So that's when I worked for Rozelle. And that was, you know, a great, extraordinary experience. I mean, he was really the most intelligent person I've ever worked for. He was in a class of his own as an administrator. I mean, we had a decent sized staff there, but we would have meetings almost every day, particularly during the period when we had labor strife and were threatened strikes and so forth. And he would just say very little during a meeting, and he'd kind of wrap it up at the end with a couple comments. And I remember walking, Harold Rosenthal, the former newspaper man, was on our staff too. And I remember walking down the stairs to our floor after one of those daily meetings. And I said to Harold, I said, well, he's amazing. He doesn't say anything until the end. And then he seems to say something that you, first thing you would think is, why didn't I think of that? He said, well, that's because he's smarter than the rest of us, Ernie. And that's really what he was. He was very intelligent, but he worked with a velvet glove. He never really got upset. He just was a tremendous person to work for.
Former Colts, former Browns, former Giants GM in Ernie Accorsi, our guest on the Professional Football Researchers Association podcast. Ernie, I know that you spend enough time in the NFL, and there's all types of pieces written about you, and you can go on and you can search your name, and I don't know if you ever do, but you see all types of things, people questioning your moves, people saying that they love your moves, whatever it may be. But the one thing I noticed that stands out to me, and I'm not just saying this to blow smoke up your butt, but everywhere you went, it seems like you were able to turn the team around and take them from being worse to being first very quickly. And I guess I want to know, from your perspective, for those listening, what was it about the way that you were able to evaluate talent that puts you in a position where you take over the Browns, they're 8-8, a couple years later, they're playing in three straight AFC championship games. You weren't there for the Giants Super Bowl run, but you set them up for it. What allowed you to evaluate talent the way you did, Ernie?
I had a great teacher. I learned from a lot of people, and as I told you, I kept notes. And the man that I knew right from the start, and we became friends really from the first day I was in the NFL with the Colts. He had just started shortly before me, was George Young. And I learned a lot about everything from George Young, particularly how to be a general manager, how to be an administrator. But the luckiest thing that happened to me was when the team was sold, it was a traumatic experience, the Colts, when Rosenblum left us and Bob Irsay bought it over, bought the club. But what he did, he brought in Joe Thomas, pretty much of a forgotten man in the National Football League, as the general manager. He had been the personnel director of the Dolphins and absolutely built that team from scratch, including one of his final acts, trading for Paul Werfield, that put with the last piece of the puzzle of that great Dolphin team. But he was the first person hired in Minnesota at their expansion team, first person hired by the Dolphins, and built both teams really from the starting block on. And he was the best evaluator of talent I've ever been around. And he did it in a very simple manner. When he first came to us, none of us knew him. I had read about him. Sports Illustrated did a real nice story about him building the Dolphins. But his wife and family did not move up from Miami to Baltimore the first year. And Joe didn't like to be alone. And he would ask me, it was pretty much of a command, to have dinner with him virtually every night. Now, that wasn't the best thing in the world for my family, but as it turned out, it was like getting a master's degree in player personnel. And we would go to dinner, and fortunately, he was a person that did a lot of talking, as compared to George, who played things pretty close to the best, and you had to really extract things from George. Joe let it flow and gave all his theories on player personnel and how he drafted. And I'll tell you, his drafts, we were at the bottom of the barrel when he came there. That championship team that had won the Super Bowl in 70 and went to the championship game in 71 had gotten old. And when he got there, he knew it and he cleaned it out and made them very unpopular because there were a lot of heroes on those teams. And he started from scratch. So in 2 years, we won three straight divisional championships. And the way he built the team, I just paid attention to everything he said. And when you watched him on draft day, forget about computers. They weren't even invented yet, but they were, it's not in football. He didn't even have files. He did everything with a legal pad. He looked at film. He went to games. He went to spring practices. They didn't have pro days in those days. He scouted with his eyes. He looked at film in those days. It was pre-tape. And as he prepared for the draft, he would get a legal pad, and he would write down 300 players in order, regardless of their position. And he'd have this legal pad, and we'd go into the draft. Now, he had complete control. He had a few scouts. We had small personnel departments. But he really, he listened to what they said, but for especially the lower rounds, there were 17 rounds in. And he paid attention to them, but he wasn't influenced. He was going to pick the way he picked. And he would always pick in order of talent, but with a slant towards position. Like once we picked Burt Jones, we weren't picking Barkowski in the next year. I don't mean he disregarded position. He did. He taught me, above all things, you can't have 22 all pros, but you better have the best teams. Your best players better be at the critical positions, quarterback. And I knew that to start with because I came to the Colts with Johnny Unitas. And I knew how important he was. Protect him, pass rush, big time receiver. He always emphasized that pass rush was his big thing. And that is how I was ingrained. And when I went to Cleveland and we came so close three times, I heard his voice because we didn't have a lot of pass rushers. We had pretty much everything else. Had we had a great pass rusher or two, we would have made a play on one of those drives with Elway. And we didn't have that. And I learned, I said, with a great quarterback, if you can't cover forever and they don't need much space, and you're only going to stop them by putting them on the ground or getting them close to the ground. And when I went to the Giants, I drafted pass rushers, till the cows came home. And much sometimes to criticism, because we already had some pretty good pass rushers, I never had enough. But it was Joe Thomas who taught me how to look at personnel. He would take me on the road with him, and he'd say, I'm not going to say a word to you. Just tell me who you thought among these guys, who were good players and what. And I would pass the eye test. I would see players. I had some instincts. But then he would say, why do you think that lineman couldn't block anybody? And I didn't know. I couldn't break it down. I was young. And he'd say, feet. He doesn't have feet. And if they don't have feet, they can't grow feet. So if you see a lineman that is, especially playing tackle, that doesn't have quick feet, don't waste time on him. Now, so he broke it down in an analytical way with his mind that just stuck with me all my career. He's the one. And I'll leave you one thought about Joe Thomas. When Ron Wolf, who's in the Hall of Fame, when he retired at his press conference, he mentioned several people, obviously Al Davis and different people along his career, and he mentioned Joe Thomas. I called him right after the press conference. I said, "What? You mentioned Joe Thomas. You never worked for Joe Thomas." He said, "I was on the road with him. He was the best evaluator of talent I've ever been around." That's when you have somebody like that to teach you, that you really trust, who can break it down like that, is not embedded in a bunch of statistical information, that's invaluable.
Do you think Joe Thomas should be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, if you're going to put scouts in, I mean, as a general manager now, he was the general manager of the Colts, and after those teams that he built, things didn't go well. He couldn't get along with a coach, couldn't get along with Ted Marchibroda, traded Unitas, and I'm not saying Unitas had a lot of his career left, but you got to be careful how you treat John Unitas in a franchise. He could never recover from that, and he didn't do a great job as general manager of the 49ers. So if you're going to put scouts in, yes, because I think he's one of the greatest scouts in history. But as a GM, he fell short.
You, through your career, Ernie, we're talking to you from Northeast Ohio. We're talking to you from Akron. So not so much John, but myself, I remember the Kozar years and the Schottenheimer years in Cleveland like the back of my hand. I mean, it just was something those years. But I wanted to ask you seemed throughout your career, and you talked about, the analysis and being able to sort of have, through preparation and everything else, being able to identify players. The one thing that you seem to be able to do that has been sort of a bugaboo for the Browns since you left the Browns is being able to pick quarterbacks. You mentioned Burk Jones. I know you wanted John Elway real bad in Baltimore. You obviously got Kozar in Cleveland. You got Eli Manning for the Giants. What was it that allowed you to be able to identify quarterbacks and say, this is the guy? Because as I said, and you well know, the Browns have been dying to find that guy, for the last, decades, and haven't been able to identify him. What was it that you were able to see in those players that said, hey, this guy is going to be great?
It's an interesting question. And to me, it's the all-time misery because mystery, not misery. And I look at so many
for Browns
high picks.
For Browns fans, it is misery, by the way.
I didn't mean it, though. But I look at it, players that have been picked high over the years and have not made it. And the thing about it, if you miss on a quarterback high, it's going to set you back for 5 years. Because if you look at 90% of them, they struggled early. I mean, even Elway struggled early. I remember reading about, I think, in one game against the Steelers his rookie year, he lined up under the guard. The guard turned around and said, John, I don't have the ball. The center does. I mean, Marino was – people forget Marino took over a team that went to the Super Bowl the year before. That wasn't a great team with David Woodley. But and Shula handled him perfectly. He didn't throw him to the Wolves right away. He started him, I think, around the fifth or sixth game. He used him in for mop-ups to get his feet wet. But for the most, and he didn't struggle as much. But for the most part, Aikman, I think, was 1-13. They all struggle. So you're going to give them time. And sometimes, even though looks like he's going to be good, the pressure's on him that he's labeled a bust if he doesn't win quickly, especially today. Because I always believed that the best thing to do with a quarterback is sit him. And I know Sonny Jurgensen told me once, I said, how did you feel when you started, not all the games, but a good portion of the games, your first 2 years, and the Eagles turn around and trade for Van Brocklin? He said, if Van Brocklin doesn't come to the Eagles, and I'm not put on the bench. I'm never in the Hall of Fame. He said, you can learn by sitting at that position. And that always had left me with an impression, but I always felt that, look, there are measurables when you evaluate a quarterback that are important. I mean, a couple quarterbacks played that were small, like Eddie LeBaron, and Drew Brees wasn't that tall. But for the most part, you're looking for size. You're looking for some mobility. And when I say mobility, I'm not interested in having a halfback back there. But even, you know, Montana didn't run. But Bill Walsh told me, he said he has the feet of a dancer. And even Kozar could stay out of trouble. He was enough. He had enough of a feel back there that you know, you didn't see him getting blitzed and sacked. In fact, if you blitzed him, you were going to pay, because he had such a quick release and a quick mind that he could get rid of the ball. So what I look for, with the measurables aside, which are obvious, you got to have a decent arm. You don't have to have a shotgun, but you have to have a very good arm, and you have to have an accurate arm. Those are the things that are important. But what I always look for is, what does he do when the game is on the line? What does he do when it's third down? What does he do in the red zone when you need to get a score? Does he make the plays? Is he a clutch player? And that's something that, even if he's with a bad team, and even if he's, you know, not doing it on a regular basis and winning national championships, I'm talking about in college, you better see glimpses of it. And certainly that's what Kozar was an unpopular pick. Flutie was the popular pick, and there were people in my organization in Cleveland who wanted to draft Flutie. And I'll tell you a quick story about him. I said, you know, I better get qualified about Flutie. And so I drove to Penn State when BC played Penn State. Penn State was a good team, the night before a game with Buffalo. And I knew that the owner, Art Modell, was, you know, loved Flutie. And I watched Flutie. And guys, he must have thrown for 80 million yards that day. And I remember they had a slow elevator with a PA system. It took that elevator was as slow as you could get from the press box to the ground level. It took the whole trip for them to stop reciting all the records he set that day as an opponent. And I thought, boy, I'm going to have a tough time, you know, saying anything negative about this guy when I get to Buffalo tomorrow. But he didn't make any – when the game was on the line, he couldn't make the plays. And one of the reasons there was they overwhelmed him, and he didn't have great size to be able to contend with it. And they were too good defensively, but now he was stepping up. They were – you know, they weren't in the ACC yet, so they weren't playing the Penn States all the time. And I always thought, in that kind of competition, he's going to have trouble. And I had a tough time selling that to my organization when it came down to it. And that's why – we had to really manipulate things. We did everything legally, but we had to really kind of navigate through the supplemental draft rules in order to get Kozar, because there were no other quarterbacks. Kelly had already been picked in by the Bills ahead of time. So we really had no, there was nowhere else to go. And you can't manufacture a quarterback. He's either good, and if you don't have one that you really feel strongly about, pass. Get somebody like Gary Danielson or someone like that can keep you alive until you get the chance to pick one. But you got to feel it somewhere in your stomach when you see one and say, this is the guy I want, because he's the guy that will come through in the clutch. And that's what I look for.
Well, why do you think, Ernie, that we've seen in today's NFL that we have so many flashes in the pan, if you will? Like, I mean, I know it's locally here, and I still think he was the guy for the Browns, but you know, Baker Mayfield has a couple of good seasons here, and then he tails off, and then, you know, Josh Allen looks brilliant for a couple weeks, but then he tails off and ends up losing to Pat Mahomes every time. Why do you think we see that so often, where these guys look great, but then some way fall on their face, or they're not committed to, when it seems like organizations were willing to work through that before? Why do you think that's happened now, where it's like it's now or never, and it's so do or die? Because I don't feel like it was always that way, was it?
No, it played too soon. I just think they played too soon. And I know, you know, everybody says I'm old-fashioned and all that, and I understand that. And I understand all the arguments against it. I understand that the pressure's different, that there's so much publicity surrounding these guys if they're picked high, that everybody wants them to play right away. I also understand that the college game's much more sophisticated. You know, you have to remember back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe even into the 80s, most college teams were playing the option, or they were playing, you know, with emphasis on running. I remember one time Vince Dooley told me at a game I was scouting in Georgia, when Florida was winning national championships, and they hadn't won an ACC championship in their history until Spurrier went there. And he said, Steve Spurrier taught this league how to pass. It would have been a running league. I understand all that. But the NFL is a different world. And I go back to what Jorgensen told me. And I know that, and we, you know, we ended up getting lucky with Burt Jones, but we always were in search of Unitas' successor, and we thought we better get one because it's going to take 3 or 4 years before he can play. And we want to play him. And as it turned out, it wasn't until after Joe Thomas traded Unitas that we drafted Burt, but we played him too soon. I mean, he was labeled a bust after the first 2 years, and we opened his rookie season in Cleveland with him as a quarterback. He didn't last long. He lasted about 4 games, and we had to bench him for a year and a half. It took him so long to recover. I don't think Plunkett ever recovered, although at the end he won 2 titles. But, you know, he got beat up so bad in New England in the beginning that, I mean, he was really at one time a free agent on the street. Anybody could have signed him before Oakland did. And a lot of guys just never recovered from the fact that they played so quickly. I know this. When we drafted Eli or traded for Eli, Coughlin and I sat down and I said, Tom, I want to carry Collins to stay as the quarterback, but he didn't want to be in that role. So I fortunately got a call from Mark Bartlestein, who was Warner's agent, and said, you know, he's a free agent. I said, well, why would he want to come with us? He said, because he wants to rebuild his career and he can help you and you can help him. So I brought Warner in, and we agreed that we were going to play Warner all year. Well, we did, and we were hanging close to first place with him. But 3/4 of the way through the season, Tom played Eli, and he almost got killed. He started off against Baltimore, the Eagles, which had that great defensive line, Atlanta, which had a very good defensive line, and Washington, and got overwhelmed. And he ended up winning the last game, but, I mean, they had started the right ball. Eli's a bust. I mean, I didn't want him to play, but they played him, and he struggled tremendously in 2004, and you know, within a year, you know, we were winning a division with him. But that, I think that's the answer. I think they played too soon, and it takes great, great patience. I know when Pittsburgh drafted the kid from Pitt, Tomlin's first reaction was, "I'm not playing him." And then he says, I want him to sit. But then the pressure gets so great on these kids. The public demands it. The media demands it, that people put them in there. And sometimes they put them in there too soon. I've seen so many of them ruined that way, or else some of them that have made it later. And you make a great point. Who knows how many of those quarterbacks, whether the Browns or anyone else, had they been put on the bench for a while, let them learn under a veteran now. You know, you don't want him in there against somebody that's the same age that is failing, because that's where the pressure starts. But if they could learn under a veteran, I mean, I did that with Danielson. I traded for Danielson after we drafted Kosar. And I said to Marty, we're playing Danielson. And he won the division for us that year. Now, we were 8-8, but he won the division for us that year before he got hurt, and Kosar played in the playoffs. But he was a great tutor for Kosar. And not only that, he will win for you too. I mean, he was crafty. He knew how to manage a game, and you know, he got us from 4-12 the year before to 8-8, and we won a division. So that's my answer to that. And like I said, I know it's changed, and I know a lot of times I live in the past, but I still believe they play too soon.
Well, and I find it interesting that I think of the two guys in my mind that I think are, you know, obviously you can argue, you know, Johnny Unitas and Joe Montana in this argument. I think George would agree with me on this, but the two most recent guys that I think of having the most success are Pat Mahomes and Tom Brady. And they both sat at first, didn't they? I mean, I think Brady sat behind Bledsoe, who was a competent, good passer. And Alex Smith, in the case of Pat Mahomes, kind of the same to Bledsoe. And look at both of them. I mean, they're going to go down as maybe one and two in history when everything is said and done. So you make a very interesting point, because I have this debate with my friends all the time, and they're always like, oh, you know, you got to see what you have. And I'm like, no, you don't. You got to be patient. You got to let him grow. You got to let him see what he can do and then put him into the game.
Hey, the scouting occurs before you get him, because if you're still scouting a while you got him, you're just among the high draft choice. Yeah. I mean, you've got to believe that this guy can do it. But, you know, I remember, you know, with so many quarterbacks that you can, it's the one position where you can grow without playing. And you can learn. You know, I go back to Jurgensen. So I sat there and watched Van Brocklin, who basically coached our offense, he said. And I thought, geez, I thought I knew the game. I didn't know the game. Heck, he threw 50 passes his senior year at Duke. Bill Murray didn't throw the ball. And Reed, you know, Brady was just way down on the depth chart and worked his way up. But Reed absolutely decided he wasn't playing Mahomes in the beginning. And, you know, he played in his rookie year, but not in the beginning. And they can learn so much by not playing. You throw them in there and they fail, and then you have to bench them. Now they've got negative thoughts. And they start to doubt themselves, too. I mean, that's a tough position. And I just believe, you know, if it means losing, it means losing in the beginning. You're building, and that guy is too precious to throw him to the wolves. And I remember Burt Jones was as talented as any quarterback I've ever been around, and that includes even watching Elway. I mean, he was really, if you saw him play when he was at his peak before he got hurt, he was John Elway before John Elway. They even looked alike. I mean, he was, but he did. He looked horrible his first 2 years, throwing interceptions, holding the ball too long. I mean, he didn't know how to play. But if he could have played under Unitas for a couple of years, even though Unitas was at the end of his career, it would have made the world a difference. Ed Marchibroda came in and saved him in 1975, and he was player of the year. But I just believe that. And I also know you're dealing with free agency now, which we didn't deal with in the early years, that, you know, he's got the clock is ticking the day you got him, although most of these guys don't play out their contracts. You sign them before that happens. But still, they don't. You only have them for 4 years before they become a free agent.
Ernie, another thing you seem to have a knack for, just looking at your history, is that I know the Browns, Modell didn't necessarily want to hire Schottenheimer as the new head coach. You were able to talk him into that, and, you know, Marty had some great years in Cleveland and beyond. I always have a fond place in my heart for Marty. I just think he did a great job wherever he was at. And then, you know, you also came along with Tom Coughlin and with the Giants. So you also, which is sometimes something missing in today's NFL, because it always seems like, you know, there's a hot commodity out there, you know, based on, you know, this coordinator, that coordinator. And, you know, sometimes those are the ones that the owners want to go after, whether it's, you know, Modell or the ownership, the mayors in New York. You know, what was it that you saw in those guys that said, this is going to be the guy that we want as our head coach over, you know, other choices?
Well, and I don't want to pat myself, but I also hired Belichick.
That's right. You know what? And I was going to, you know, I'm sorry. When I was thinking through the question, I was going to mention Belichick. I, who knew that, you know, I mean, you know, of course he had, you know, the ultimate career, but yeah, you also,
right.
You
but also, I mean, he you didn't also, win in Cleveland, but I,
no.
Yeah. I'll tell you two quick stories about, and I'll make them fast, about Schottenheimer. And this kind of leads into what I'm going to tell you, what I looked at first, which was leadership. Well, number one, in Baltimore, we claimed him in 1971 on waivers. He was at the end of his career. We needed a linebacker right before our last preseason game in Jacksonville against the Raiders. I was advancing the team, so I was away, and I got a call from the coach and said, you know, get a room for Schottenheimer. We just picked him up this week, and I'm going to play him in this game. So in those days, you know, it was before jetways. I mean, they would walk down the stairway descending from a plane, and Rosenblum, who was the owner, insisted that I stay there and handed each player with a key. He didn't want any delays. You know, everything was pro player. And he wanted them to go into the hotel room and go right to their room. You wouldn't have to sit, mill around the lobby looking for their room key. So I'm handing the keys to these players. It was a veteran team. Here comes Schottenheimer down the steps. Now, I don't know him, but I will say that I knew it had to be him, okay, because I knew most of the other players. It was still a preseason roster. And he stands in front of me, and I said, what's your name? He said, you don't know my name? I said, this isn't a quiz show. You're holding up five Hall of Famers behind you. Now, if you want a room, what's your name, okay? I knew who he was, but he was kind of trying to big dog me a little bit. So I give him the room key. That's my only impression of him. Now, I go to Cleveland, and he's the defensive coordinator. And all I know about him is he's the guy that was standing in front of me and wouldn't tell me his name coming down the steps. So I watched him for the half a season. We won 1-7. And I never saw anyone more diligent. After a game, he'd get on an airplane, he'd go right to work. Other guys might be having a beer, talking, the road game I'm talking about, and he would go right to work. And I just saw how intense he was. So now Modell decides to make the move in midseason to fire Rattigliano, and we're at Modell's house. And he calls Schottenheimer and asks him to come out to the house. He said, I want to talk to you about the head coaching position. So it's taken him forever to get there. Well, number one tells you something about Marty. He drove right to Rattigliano's house to ask him how he felt about him taking over. He then comes out there, and Modell said, all right, I'm going to give you a trial. You can coach the last seven games, and we'll decide at the end of the year whether we keep you or not. And Schottenheimer says, I don't want the job. And Modell says, what? He said, I'm not taking a job. Do you think they're going to play for me if they think I'm on trial? He said, I want a three-year contract, or I'm not taking the job. So Modell takes me in the kitchen, and he says, what do you think we're going to do? I said, give him the three-year contract. I said, anybody who takes it, the guy has no guarantee. He's coming off a team that's 1-7. He has no guarantee he's going to get a head coaching job or any job. If he's got that kind of courage and confidence in himself, hire him. I said, because if he turns it down, I'm not coaching this team, Mark. So I don't know what your choice is going to be after him. And, you know, that's Marty. And I loved Marty Schottenheimer. I mean, of all the coaches I've been around as far as a personal relationship and a personal affection, I love the guy. We didn't agree on everything. We headed out on the Mike Junkin draft choice. I wanted Jerome Brown, and I lost that battle. But I lost some personnel battles with him because I didn't even have a contract, nor did I have authority written down. It was like who could talk, the owner into it. But we got along, though. The thing, even when we disagreed on personnel, it never affected our relationship. I thought he was a great coach.
Last couple thoughts here that we have for you is Ernie, of course, he is our guest, former Browns GM, former Giants GM, former Colts GM, worked with the Penn State Nittany Lions and Joe Paterno, and has been in the game of football for so many years. Ernie, one of the things I want to ask you, because it comes up a lot around here in Northeast Ohio, and it's kind of floating around in the media again now, too, but the Browns move. In the 90s, and just that whole situation revolving around wanting a new stadium and Modell and the whole thing, and now the Browns are saying they want a new stadium again. And I guess I want to ask you, do you see parallels in that now with the Browns? And what allowed that situation to transpire back in the 90s when it did, to put such a hard position between the city and the organization?
Well, first of all, I'm not familiar with it. This is the first time I've heard they're looking to have a new stadium. And I don't know the situation in the current situation. I will tell you that I know this. Now, they moved after I left, but I know this. Art, when things, you know, when the baseball team wasn't drawing at all, and we were drawing, but that obviously that stadium was outdated at that point, as historic and wonderful as it was for football. Art went to the city. The council that was involved, this had a name. I can't remember something about Cleveland. It had a name. He went to the committee and said, take care of the Indians first. He said, Don't let them leave. Team that loses a Major League Baseball team, all of a sudden it's not a Major League city. Take care of them. Then we'll address our situation. But we're okay. But they're never going to draw in that stadium and take care of them first. And they did. So when it came time for what Art told me is I was gone, but when it came time for, okay, now I need help and I got to get a new stadium, I don't think they had the money to build two stadiums. And he basically, from what I'm telling, I wasn't involved in the finances of the Browns. I was strictly in player personnel. Jim Bailey was the attorney and he was more involved in that than he was totally involved in that. So I don't know, but I from what I was told, Art couldn't have afforded to keep the team. Remember now, he sold increments to a minority partner named Bob Grease, and Bob Grease kept increasing his shares to the point where all of a sudden Art wasn't getting 100% of the profits. I mean, I think Grease had up to – Art still had control over – the league had a rule then, yet you had to have one person owned over 50%. Doesn't exist anymore. But you in those days you did. Art still had over 50%, but I think Grease had up in the mid-40s. So he wasn't making all the money that he could have been making had he owned 100% of the team. So that's what I'm told, that he couldn't afford to keep the team when he moved it. But obviously that was, a heartbreaking situation. Those fans they're wonderful fans. I mean, when you saw, you remember this, 80,000 people in that stadium for a big game, for the Steeler game or whatever game. I mean, there was no sound like it with that many people and the way that stadium held the crowd noise. It was incredible, that franchise. And thank God for Tagliabue, because he did something I wish would have been done with the Colts. He preserved the name, he preserved the colors, and he got Cleveland a team. And I know it's not the same franchise, but it was almost seamless. And that was a great thing for the town, because, I wish as an original Baltimore Colt, and I grew up a Colt fan. I grew up in southeastern Pennsylvania. I wish that was the Baltimore Colts instead of the Ravens. And it's just, for me, now for the younger last three generations, it doesn't matter. But for my generation, that left a hole that there were no Baltimore Colts in Baltimore. So at least Tagliabue moved quickly and really salvaged the tradition. But that's what I was told of what happened there. That actually it was his graciousness in the beginning. And I know that I was there when he made that gesture. Take care of the Indians first. Because listen, and you remember this, I loved baseball. So when the off season, in the spring and early summer before camp, I would walk out of my office and go down and watch a few innings every night. And the place was empty. It was like a mausoleum. Unless the Yankees were there, and then maybe they had 15,000. So they, in order to salvage that franchise, they had to have a new stadium, and he knew it.
Ernie, you worked for some iconic owners in NFL history. I know you worked for obviously Rosenblum was still there with the Colts, and then you the Maras in New York, obviously Modell in Cleveland. I'm not going to put Ursay into the iconic category, but I know that you had some. Run-ins with Ursay and the whole Elway situation. What were your relationships with your various ownership groups?
You're right. I worked for, some great owners. I mean, look, Wellington Mara, and Bob Tisch was great too, the partner. Wellington Mara is a saint. He just was the most gracious, wonderful man that I've never, ever known in my career. I mean, and Art treated me well. I know that when I first went to Cleveland, I he bailed me out, because after the Elway thing, I had to leave the Colts. And, it was an 0-8-1 team, and it was a strike year. And we went 7-9, and I thought, you better go now, because at least we got back to respectability. And that season, my only full season there, we were 4-2 and 6-4. Twice we were playing for first place. We didn't win those games. We ended up 7-9. But I thought, I don't think it's going to get better than this. So if I want another job, and I called him, and he gave me a job. And in the beginning, it was just my first year there. I was just signing players, but he saved my career. And I'd recently divorced. My kids were still in Baltimore, and he made sure I got home to see their football games and to be my daughter's father and daughter dances. And that meant the world to him. And he really took care of me. He was great. And of course, Rosenblum was a great owner. If he would have stayed as owner of the Colts, I don't think they would have ever moved, because we would have won. I mean, he was a winner. And he was tough, but I really enjoyed him. And I say this about Bob Irsay. No, we had our rocky times over, but he did give me my first general manager's job. Now, it wasn't necessarily the pick of all the jobs. He fired Szymanski during minicamp. He walked into me and he says, "You're the new general manager." I said, "Can I go home and talk to my family about it?" He said, "Well, if you don't take it, you're gone too." So I had no choice, and I didn't get a pay raise. So that was, I call that the accidental. There's a book called Accidental President. That's the accidental general manager's job. So I knew that was going to be short term from this, but I'm grateful that he gave me my first general manager job. So yeah, I worked for great owners. I'm grateful for that.
All right, Ernie, last question for you here. My brother's college roommate is the biggest Giants fan I know. And, he loved the years of Strahan and the David Tyree catch and the Mario Manningham catch and everything that you helped build with Tom Coughlin. And the overarching question over all of it has always been, is Eli Manning a Hall of Famer after everything was said and done in his career? You drafted the kid. You watched him grow and blossom. So I want to ask you now, because I know that time is coming up for him. His brother Peyton's in. His dad obviously had a solid career in the NFL. But is Eli worthy of a gold jacket one day?
Well, I guess I'm the last guy that probably is objective about this. But I am not making this statement based on that this is his cornerstone. But I only drafted a quarterback for one reason. Will he win championships? That's all. I don't care about his one-loss record. I care less about his one-loss record. And I know his one-loss record is 500. You look at Weeb Eubank, too. He was kept out of the NFL. I mean, out of the Hall of Fame for years because he was either a game under 500 or even 500. He won 3 world championships. That's why you hire a coach. That's why you hire a quarterback. And when I hear people say on certain quarterbacks, well, you know, he had a good career. Well, he had a good career. He didn't win any championships. Now, sooner or later, that guy's got to come up with plays. And you owe him an obligation to surround him with a championship team. But Eli has 2 world championships, and the only quarterback who's won 2 world championships who's not in the Hall of Fame is Plunkett. Every one of them, I mean, you look at Favre, he won one. Rodgers, so far, he still has a chance. That was 1-1. And the thing about it, you can say, well, he wasn't a passenger. He wasn't exactly a passenger on the bus. He led them on 2 drives to win those 2 championships. In the late game stages of the fourth quarter, both times he did that. And I always say that the first Super Bowl, I was hoping he'd do it. And I really, in the second one, I knew he was going to do it. I just had this feeling. In fact, I remember thinking, don't do it too soon. Because you don't want to leave Brady 1 second, let alone 20 seconds. So do I think he should be in? Yeah. He won 2 titles. And he came into a franchise that wasn't winning. It was 4-12 a year before, and I think he earned that. Whether he'll get in or not, I don't know, because people hold the one loss record against them. And he, you know, that went down late in the career when they just, the talent, you know, when those two Super Bowl teams, the talent got old, and it was never replenished properly because he didn't really have much to work with.
You know, what's funny is our whole conversation comes full circle. Earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that the one thing you look at with quarterbacks is that clutch gene that they have. And I would argue that I don't think anybody had it better than Eli Manning. I mean, those 2 drives, I can remember sitting on my parents' couch in high school for both of those and watching those and just being amazed at the throws he could make. He definitely had that. And that's, I'm guessing that's why you went with him, isn't it?
It wasn't. I saw him his junior year. We suspected, because the team was not good at Mississippi, that he might come out. And that's un-Manning-like, but we thought he might. So I went to see him on a freezing day in Oxford, Mississippi against Auburn, and I wanted to see him against one of the better teams in the league. And he kept single-handedly getting them ahead, and they couldn't hold. He'd take them down on a drive. They'd go ahead. Auburn would score in five plays because Auburn was – there was nobody on that Mississippi team that played in the NFL. I think he might have had one player or receiver who had a cup of coffee, and he stayed in school. And the next year, I went to see him against, ironically, again against Auburn on the road. And that team he took to the Cotton Bowl and won it. So, yes, that was the thing about him. And, you know, he played at Mississippi at a time when they were in the second level. They weren't, you know, they weren't Alabama, Georgia, Florida, LSU. And they were in the second level. I mean, they were with Kentucky and Vanderbilt. They were in that middle level with Tennessee and probably Mississippi State. But they had a struggle to beat the big teams, and it was all on his shoulders.
Ernie, I do have to ask you one last question before we close, and I was remiss earlier in not mentioning that you hired Belichick. What did you see in Belichick?
Well, it's interesting because one coach that didn't work out, although he took us to the championship game his first year, was Bud Carson. And I thought at the end of that Schottenheimer era that team had one last gasp left. And you know, I sort of grew up with Earl Weaver, and I thought I had been with Bud Carson my first year when I became general manager. And he was a crafty, smart coach, and he a veteran. And I thought, you know, that this team needs a guy like him that maybe we can still steal a title. Did get us to the championship game, so I hired Bud Carson. I pretty much had decided that's where I was going to go, and Belichick called and said, can I at least have an interview? And I knew his dad, and I said, yeah, sure. So I met with him. I said, I want to go to, it was at the Senior Bowl. I said, I want to go to practice. So we'll have lunch at the Mobile Marriott. And I sat down with him, and I will tell you guys, I missed practice. I stayed there with him. I was captivated by him, his knowledge, his sense of history of the game, his quick mind. It was everything about him impressed me. And I remember walking out of there and I said, you know, I hate to put it in this terms, Bill, the golf tournament's over, but you just shot a 63 in the fourth round and almost won it, okay? And I never forgot that interview. And when we converse, he still talks about that interview. I sent him a note when he passed Hallis, I guess. And he answered back. He says, I'll never forget our interview in Mobile. And that was the interview that pretty much got him the job 2 years later, rather than an interview after, you know, when we did hire him. He was just, he reminded me of somebody, and this turned out to be literally true, who had been preparing to be an NFL head coach from the time he was 5 years old. And that's probably true with his father there. I mean, he used to sit by his father's side watching film and going on the road to scout and everything else. He was a brilliant football mind. And I loved his sense of history of the game. That's what I really liked, because that means a lot to me. And he was a young guy compared to me. He isn't very young now, but he's in fact, one of his notes, he says, how did we get so old? Well, we're still around, so I'm not complaining. But no, that's where I really saw in Belichick.
Well, I can tell you this, Ernie. We here at the Pro Football Researchers Association, we appreciate people that appreciate the history of the game and hold it near and dear to their heart. And you're certainly one of those folks. And we thank you so much for joining us on the pod. George and I were just tickled when you said yes, that you would come on and chat with us. And thanks for carving out this hour and allowing us to pick your brain and even let people know that you had a pretty good golf swing back in the day. Maybe one day we'll be able to get together and get out on the course, all three of us.
That swing is a long gone, I can tell you that. But listen, guys, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed talking to you guys. And yes, I love the whole preservation of the history of the game. We got a television set in 1950, and I still remember seeing the 1950 championship game as a little kid, 9 years old. But no, I love the history of the game. I love what you guys do, and this has been as much fun for me as it has been for you, I hope.
Ernie, thanks for joining us, and have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again soon, my friend.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Hello, football friends. This is Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and I'd like to invite you to the portal of positive football history, Pigskin Dispatch and PigskinDispatch.com. We talk about everything that centers around the game of American football, expert discussions, the origins of the games, the great players, teams, and coaches, and more, as some great guests and insights from experts. We have new episodes 3 to 4 times a week, and you can find us on SportsHistoryNetwork.com, PigskinDispatch.com, or your favorite podcast provider.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.